Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, as we approach the 7th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, a detailed look at the operations of the 9/11 Commission. Now, that was the independent commission authorized by Congress to investigate the terrorist attacks and the U.S. response to those attacks. My guest, investigative reporter Philip Sheehan, covered the commission for The New York Times. He says the 9/11 Commission was the last best hope to understand why September 11th happened and if it had to happen. But he says he found significant shortcomings in the commission's work, oversights, omissions, and distortions. And my guest says the full truth about the 9/11 attacks has not yet been told. Philip Sheehan, former reporter for The New York Times, now an independent journalist, having retired from The Times, his current book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Phil Sheehan, welcome to Open Line. Good to have you here.
Fred, thanks for having me.
We're at 614-292-8513. If you have a comment or question, you can email comments and questions to openline@wosu.org. Well, Phil, you dedicate your book to the memory of the people who died that day and to their families who are still trying to get the full truth told. What are the major gaps in terms of the full truth? What don't we know that you think we would like to know and should know?
Well, I think we need to know an awful lot more about what it is exactly that the federal government knew about terrorist threats before 9/11. It turned out that 9/11 was kind of predicted, that there was an awful lot of evidence in the bowels of the federal government in 2001 suggesting that something terrible was about to happen. And a lot of this information was presented to the White House in the spring and summer of 2001, just weeks before the attacks. And it does appear the White House did very little with the information it was given. And I think we as taxpayers need to understand what it is that the federal government knew, because apparently the federal government knew an awful lot.
Mm-hmm. We say the federal government, but there might be an FBI agent here, an FBI agent there that understood certain situations. But how much of this material actually got coordinated and could conceivably have gotten to the White House?
Well, but an awful lot did and an awful lot didn't. And I suppose it's more important that we know what it is that was within the federal government that was not passed along to the White House. You know, I think one of the big disclosures of my book is the fact that the 9/11 Commission spent very little time determining what was inside the National Security Agency. This is the largest spy agency in the federal government, the big eavesdropping agency, and it is the source of most of the raw information that goes into the federal government about terrorist threats, from its eavesdropping satellites and its eavesdropping equipment on phone lines. It gathers most of the raw information that the government has about al-Qaeda and about other terrorist groups. And it appears the 9/11 Commission just never bothered to take the time to go into the NSA and to figure out what it knew before 9/11 about terrorist threats.
Mm-hmm. So there's a huge amount of raw data at the NSA, and you write that they were fully open to people coming and taking a look at it, but the commission staff didn't go to see this material until the final days of the commission almost.
It's pretty remarkable that the NSA, which, as I say, in budget terms is the largest spy agency in the government, much larger than the CIA, told the 9/11 Commission very early on in the investigation that it welcomed the commission's investigators to come to the NSA and see what it was that the government knew about terrorist threats before 9/11. And the commission, for a whole bunch of reasons, just never bothered to send the investigators out to look. And I think there's a belief on the part of a lot of 9/11 Commission staff members that there are still an awful lot of secrets of the NSA that nobody knows about.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think they didn't bother to send the staff members over there? Did they have sufficient staff? Because I know they were also talking to the CIA and the FBI and everybody else.
Yeah, the staff resources aren't the question here. The answer seems to be, unfortunately, that the 9/11 Commission just didn't see the NSA as a particularly sexy agency to investigate. They were much more interested in trying to get into the bowels of the CIA at Langley, Virginia, and out to the FBI. They just thought they were sexier targets than the NSA.
Hmm.
And there were staff members who wanted desperately to get into the bowels of the NSA, but they were essentially bureaucratically blocked by the leadership of the commission from doing that.
Well, this commission, Phil, it sounds like you're right, in the commission was very political from the very beginning. I mean, Thomas Kane, the commission chair, former Republican governor of New Jersey, said, "We're not here to point the finger at anybody." So if they weren't there to point the finger at anybody who might have failed, to alert us to the terrorist threat, what were they there to do?
Well, An excellent question. I mean, you can't really imagine a more political animal than the 9/11 Commission. They were five Democrats chosen by the most partisan members of their party, and five Republicans chosen by the most partisan members of their party that were supposed to come to unanimity about the biggest terrorist attack on American soil that we have ever known. And Kane, who's actually Tom Kane, the former governor of New Jersey, who's actually one of the least political figures on the commission, the chairman of the commission, decides very early on that in order to come to unanimity, the commission has to be out of the business of finger-pointing, of personal accountability. And his instructions were followed. At the end of the day, the 9/11 Commission came to almost no conclusions about whether individual human beings had messed up before 9/11, when I think the staff will tell you that there's an awful lot of evidence to suggest that there were individuals to blame and that they should have been blamed.
Mm-hmm. The staff will tell you that in your conversations with them after the commission retired?
Right. I covered the commission for a couple of years, and I thought I was doing good work, and I thought I was getting to the real truth about what the 9/11 Commission was up to. And it turned out, after the commission went out of business in 2004, that there was an awful lot I didn't know. And the reason I didn't know it was because during the commission's work, the staff of the commission, the people who were really doing the digging, were barred from talking to the press. After the commission went out of business, the staff was suddenly available to me, and they had some incredible detective stories to tell, stories about the digging they did and the battles they fought with the White House. But in many ways, more importantly, they told me the stories of the battles within the commission and the battles between the staff and the man who was really running the investigation, a historian by the name of Philip Zelikow, who's a very important figure in my book.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say the commission staff hinted to you that indeed there were people who the finger could be pointed at. Did they name them?
There were certainly people. The commission felt there was plenty of blame to go around, and there were certainly people who needed to be held accountable for the mistakes they had made before 9/11. None of those names were named in the commission's final report, and some of those people, as a result of not being held accountable, not only were not demoted or fired after 9/11, some of them were promoted after 9/11 and continued to serve in the federal government.
But did the commission staff, after the commission closed, in their conversations with you, you say they hinted that there were people who should be named or could be named. Did they name any for you then?
They did. I mean, I think there's certainly a feeling on the part of many staff members that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is at the center of everything that went wrong before 9/11 at the White House. And that she should have been held accountable for the fact that so much of the intelligence reaching the White House was not acted upon by the White House. But as we say, there was no accountability. She was not held responsible in the final report of the 9/11 Commission.
The National Security Advisor in the Clinton administration, Sandy Berger, there was a story to tell about him. But was he one of those who went to Condoleezza Rice and said, look, pay attention to this?
The story is told, and it's certainly true, I believe, that in January of 2001, when the new Bush administration comes to Washington, he tries to brief his successor, Condoleezza Rice, about what are the dangers in the world, what is it she's going to have to worry about over the next 4 years, and he sits her down and says, the number one thing you're going to have to worry about is this terrorist group called Al Qaeda, and that you're going to spend more time on this than on any other national security threat. But Berger would later say that he had the impression that Rice was not paying much attention to that warning. And not only was he not paying much attention, nor was her counterterrorism advisor on the White House transition team, who turns out to be this same fellow, Philip Zelikow, from the University of Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Sandy Berger said he had the feeling she wasn't paying much attention to him, but isn't he also a person? I mean, can we trust that word? In other words, he was the one who stole documents from the National Archives because he was afraid that something would be pinned on him, that he wouldn't have been on the watch. So isn't it to his advantage to pin it on Condoleezza Rice?
It sure is. But I will say, though, there's other evidence to support his account of that, including the testimony of Richard Clark, who was the counterterrorism advisor in the National Security Council, both in the Clinton administration and for President Bush, who served on Condoleezza Rice's staff. He agrees that Berger told her, and he, Clark, told her that Al-Qaeda was the big threat. Yet it sure seemed that never sunk in with Condoleezza Rice.
Of course, I suppose it's one thing to say that al-Qaeda is the big threat, but another to predict what al-Qaeda is going to do, right?
Sure. But I think they were predicting that al-Qaeda was going to continue to attack America and its allies around the world and potentially within American borders.
Mm-hmm. You know, the first attack on the World Trade Center, you know, was it 93, is that right?
Sure.
When the truck bomb went off and you would think that maybe after that time, both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration and New York City authorities would have thought, gee, maybe they'll try again. I mean, but they didn't appear to.
Well, I think this involves all those people, all those agencies. It's particularly true of the New York City government, which is that in 1993, as you say, the World Trade Center was bombed. Muslim extremists tried to bring down the World Trade Center in 1993. And in the 8 years that followed, the 8 years between 93 and September 11, 2001, it appears the New York City government, led by a fellow by the name of Rudolph Giuliani, did precious little to prepare the city for a terrorist attack that certainly could have been predicted. Why is it terribly surprising that 8 years after Muslim terrorists attacked the World Trade Center in New York, they try again? I think it's only to be assumed that New York City remained a big target, the World Trade Center remained a big target, and yet the New York City government seems to have done very little to prepare the city for what was coming.
And Phil, help me with my chronology on this one, but wasn't both the Clinton and Bush administrations, could they not both have been aware of the fact that terrorists were planning to use airplanes as bombs? Because wasn't there a situation in which terrorists they were stopped from flying an airplane into the Eiffel Tower? And wasn't that before the Bush administration?
Well, this was a big myth presented after 9/11, that who could have imagined that planes would be used as missiles against tall buildings in the United States or elsewhere in the world. The fact is that there was plenty of evidence, both secret evidence within the federal government and evidence that was on the front pages of newspapers around the world to suggest that something just like this was going to happen someday. And in fact, there had been a terrorist plot in the early 1990s by a group of Muslim extremists to hijack a plane and launch it into the Eiffel Tower in Paris. And it turned out after 9/11 that there were an awful lot of secret reports within the bowels of the government about just this threat, planes as missiles.
Mm-hmm. So could the 9/11 Commission, it did not say this, but could it have reasonably stated in a conclusion that, number one, there had been an attack on the World Trade Center, it was reasonable to suspect a second one. Number two, both Clinton and Bush administrations understood that planes could be used by terrorists as bombs. Number three, it would be reasonable to put those two suppositions together. And number four, do something about it.
Yes, they could have said all that just as directly as you said it, but they don't. They
mm-hmm.
didn't.
My guest, Philip Sheehan, covered the 9/11 Commission investigation for the New York Times, and his current book is The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. So, Phil, of course, as you point out, the commission it ceased its activities. It wrote its report in the spring of 2004, and it had, 30 months? And it was insisted that it do this within that time period because no one wanted to have a last-minute October surprise for the 2004 elections, right?
Exactly. The idea was on the part of the White House and Republicans in Congress was to force the commission to report well before the November 2004 elections, and the commission did finally report in August of 2004.
Now, the Bush administration attempted, did they not, to stop this commission? They didn't want this independent commission formed, right?
They were dead set against it at the beginning. They were sort of forced into accepting a 9/11 commission, but it took very intensive lobbying by the 9/11 families and by John McCain, the then maverick, I guess still maverick, Republican senator from Arizona, who really insisted on there being an independent investigation.
Mm-hmm. And so the executive office of the president got to pick the chair of the commission, is that right? And the first pick was Henry Kissinger, as you recount.
Right. And Henry Kissinger dropped out very quickly. And for reasons that I think I explained in the book, there was a very dramatic confrontation between Kissinger and some of the 9/11 widows, the so-called Jersey girls. In his offices in Manhattan in December 2002. And the very next day after this confrontation, Kissinger called the the White House and stepped down.
Mm-hmm. And he called the White House and stepped up because he did not want to reveal. He has a Kissinger Associates, I guess it is, that has clients perhaps in the Middle East, maybe even in Saudi Arabia.
Right. The concern was on the part of the 9/11 families that Kissinger had a whole bunch of conflicts of interest. You know, perhaps most importantly, the fact that he was very close to George Bush and a supporter of the president's, and he might go out of his way to defend the president and the investigation. But beyond that, you know, Kissinger leads a big international consulting firm, and the 9/11 families wanted Kissinger to reveal his client list, his secret client list, which they believed might include some big Arab companies, some big energy companies that might not want a full investigation of 9/11. Kissinger refused and stepped down.
In fact, one of them not ask him directly, Mr. Kissinger, do you have any Saudi Arabian clients or any clients named bin Laden?
Well, I got to say, that's one of my favorite anecdotes of the book, which is that Kissinger invites the 9/11 widows into his offices in New York, and the questions start coming hot and heavy at him about his client list and about making it public. And one of the widows sort of very bravely asks, and very directly asks, you know, Dr. Kissinger, do you have any clients named bin Laden? And Kissinger apparently spills his coffee, nearly falls off the sofa, literally. essentially, that seems to be the moment at which Dr. Kissinger decides he's no longer going to run this investigation.
Yeah, and there were other, you know, George Mitchell, the former senator from Maine, right, was asked to do it. He couldn't do it. So we wind up with Commission Chair Thomas Kane, for, as you say, Republican governor of New Jersey, highly respected person. And Lee Hamilton, the commission vice chair, right, a former congressman, is that right? And
right.
They seem to take a very cautious approach, as you write. Commissioner Kane said, we're not here to point the finger at anybody. But then they also hire this fellow you mentioned earlier, Philip Zelikow, this historian, as the executive director of the commission. Tell us about him.
Well, we should start by saying, I think that, you know, there is this polite fiction in Washington and elsewhere that when a blue ribbon commission issues a report, that the report is written by the blue ribbon commissioners. That is almost never the case. Certainly in Washington, those reports are usually written by a professional staff. In Washington, that tends to be sort of congressional researchers or academics, often quite young. And that was certainly the case with the 9/11 commission. And that sort of commission is usually run by some sort of outside staff director or executive director in this case, again, somebody to run the day-to-day investigation for the commissioners. The 9/11 commission hired on Philip Zelikow, this historian from the University of Virginia, a very well-respected historian at the University of Virginia, to run the day-to-day investigation, even though he was close friends with many of the people who were right at the heart of the investigation, most importantly, Condi Rice.
He had co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice.
Well, they had ties that go way back, which is they had worked together in the National Security Council staff for the first President Bush. They went on to write a book together, Rice and Zelikow. When Rice was named National Security Advisor to the current President Bush, she hired on Zelikow for her transition team for the National Security Council and put him in charge of counterterrorism activities. He was to review how the White House dealt with terrorist threats. And again, this is early 2001, just months before the 9/11 attacks. Mm-hmm. So it certainly seems that he was not only a friend of many of the people at the heart of this investigation, he was an architect of the White House counterterrorism strategy that obviously didn't perform well in September of 2001.
You also write, Phil, that on the other hand, he was very aggressive with the White House in saying they wanted what are called the PDBs, the presidential daily briefing that he gets from the intelligence agencies, that he felt strongly the commission should have access to all of them, and the White House didn't want to give him that access.
Right. Well, Zelikow is a fascinating character. There was the perception that he was a White House mole on the investigation, that he'd been placed there by the White House. That certainly doesn't seem to be the case. And in fact, over time, I think there are members of the staff who will tell you that Zelikow's instincts as an historian, and a rather abrasive historian at that, overwhelmed everything else. And he was at the forefront of efforts by the commission to demand that the White House turn over lots of secret documents, including the president's daily brief, which is the as we now know, this sort of super secret newspaper that's given to the president every morning about national security threats.
Now, the commission never got all of those, is that right?
Selected member. Well, there was one Democrat and Zelico who were given access to the entire universe of PDBs that might be pertinent to the 9/11 Commission investigation, but they were the only two people who saw all of them.
Mm-hmm. And what do we know from those PDBs? There was one, I guess, in August of 2001, titled "Bin Laden Determined to Attack Within the U.S."
Well, what we learned is that as I say, these are just about the most secret documents in the federal government. The president's daily brief, it's the super secret newspaper, tiny readership. The president, the vice president, and a couple of other people, including the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, get to see this thing. And the White House insisted that the 9/11 Commission not be allowed to see them. Now, there was a big fight over that, and eventually the 9/11 Commission got in to see some of the PDBs. And the PDB showed that on dozens of occasions in the spring and summer of 2001, the president was told directly about al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda threats. And there's this explosive PDB that was written on August 6, 2001, just weeks before 9/11, that was headlined, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S.," and was a reasonably clear warning to the president that there was evidence, current evidence out there, of a domestic terrorist threat that could involve hijackings and then could involve attacks on the skyline of New York City. And certainly the evidence shows that very little was done with that PDB.
So in other words, right within the text of that PDB, it said it could involve hijacking of planes. It could involve attacks on skyscrapers in New York, did it?
It is remarkable that essentially this document says to the president of the United States, just weeks before 9/11, we believe there is an ongoing terrorist threat within the United States, that there is evidence of recent surveillance of the skyline of New York City, and that this somehow could involve domestic hijacking. There was a who, what, and where here.
So it was fairly specific.
A lot of the detail in the PDB was wrong, but a lot of it was right, and it was fairly specific. If you told law enforcement agencies around the country that there's a domestic terrorist threat that could involve the skyline, attacks on the skyline in New York City, you have to wonder if the world would be a little different today.
But nothing was done with this memo.
I guess it's wrong to say nothing, but very little was done with it.
So I think has Condoleezza Rice said about that memo? In other words, the existence and the text of the memo are known. What has her response to that memo?
Well, her response has been that the White House was acting aggressively and quickly to all of the warnings that was given during 2001 about terrorist threats. The August 6th PDB is sort of the clearest intelligence, but there was a lot of other warning material that was going into the White House in the spring and summer. And she says the White House was acting quickly and aggressively, but many people on her staff will tell you differently, that they will tell you, and Dick Clark, Richard Clark, the counterterrorism advisor, most clearly will tell you that this information was being blown off, that it was being ignored.
But people on her staff will also tell you that.
Well, Dick Clark was on her staff.
Yeah.
She was his boss.
In addition to Dick Clark, other people will say the same thing?
Yeah, and absolutely.
Philip Sheehan covered the 9/11 Commission for the New York Times. His new book is The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. We're going to take a break here and call us then. We're going to get right to you. I'm back with my guest at WOSU 820, NPR News.
Worries of a new Cold War, hot wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, economic rivalry and partnership with China. The next president faces enormous challenges. I'm Neil Conan, America in the World. Ted Koppel joins us to talk with a senior advisor to John McCain. Plus the opinion page and your calls. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It's 69 degrees at 10:30. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine Shodich at 247-4469. That's Christine at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News. In the weather forecast for today, sunny skies today and a nice day, a high of 82. Clouds move in overnight, bringing a chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm after midnight, and a low of 58. For Tuesday, cloudy in the morning with a chance of rain, and then some sunshine in the afternoon, and cooler on Tuesday, a high of 72. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. As we approach the 7th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, a detailed look at the operations of the 9/11 Commission. Now, it was an independent commission authorized by Congress to investigate the terrorist attacks and the U.S. response to those attacks. Investigative reporter Philip Sheenan covered the commission for the New York Times, and his new book is The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. 614-292-8513. Callers, let's go right to you. Sean is first. Hello, Sean.
Good morning. Thanks for doing this topic. I just, within the past couple of months, really gotten into reading a lot of the history of 9/11, sort of the stuff that's out there in the official 9/11 Commission report, but also the Loose Chains video, and I just finished reading Debunking 9/11, Debunking by David Ray Griffin, and I had... had a couple of, I guess, observations. And
well, no, let's get to a question if we can, Sean.
Okay. Well, I guess the main question that I have, and I don't know if your guest can answer it or not, but you have three buildings: World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7. And I was surprised, just realized a couple of months ago, that 7 fell the same day. I thought it was detonated later, but it turns out it fell the same day without any demolitions being put in it by anyone. So my question is, you have three buildings that are attacked in three different ways. Now, the two planes hit World Trade Center 1 and 2, but they didn't hit exactly the same way, either building. And then you have 7 that wasn't hit by a plane at all, and yet they all fell perfectly straight down on top of themselves. Now, NIST has done a $20 million report that says that here's how they fell. But NIST is part of the Department of Commerce, which is part of the White House.
I think we understand the sense of the question, and maybe Phil, this is maybe moving in the direction of the idea of some sort of something we don't know in terms of people have alleged Bush administration conspiracy in terms of 9/11. I don't know what's your thought about all this.
Well, I face these questions wherever I go. There is a belief, and apparently it's pretty widespread, that 9/11 was some sort of inside job, that the Bush administration, working with others, brought down the Twin Towers and this building nearby, World Trade Center 7 was its name, through some sort of controlled demolition. I have seen no evidence to support this. There was a recent study just in the last couple of weeks from NIST, the National Institute of, I'm blank on its full name. You can find its report at www.nist.gov, a report that is widely supported by architects and engineers in the outside world, outside the government, that suggests that there was nothing, there were no explosives involved in bringing down the planes, and that this third building, World Trade Center 7, came down because of a fire that went off in some of the center floors, because the sprinkler systems had been shut off because there was no water circulating because of the crisis in Lower Manhattan at that point. But as I say, I do face these questions wherever I go, and I'm not sure how we can debunk some of these larger conspiracy theories that seem to have taken hold.
But nonetheless, you feel that there's an adequate explanation here based on the NIST report and other reports as well.
Well, I found very little evidence to suggest the idea of a larger conspiracy within the federal government. One thing I know after having spent so long with this information is that, to carry out a conspiracy of that magnitude and that level of evil takes a degree of secrecy and competence that I am very convinced, does not exist within the federal government.
Okay.
And I do know that a secret like that could not have been kept for 7 years.
Okay.
Or at least I find it very hard to believe it could be kept for 7 years.
Sean, do you have a quick follow-up question? Okay.
I just wanted to say that I think David Wright Griffin's book, I can't possibly enumerate all the reasons why I am skeptical of the official report. I'm not saying necessarily that it was an inside job, but I don't think that the 9/11 Commission report, nor did the NIST report, the $20 million study they did it sufficiently answer the questions. I think if you read David Wright Griffin's book, it does do a factual analysis of what's out there.
Okay, must move on. Thank you, Sean. Thanks for your call. Got to go. Delbert is on the line. Hi, Delbert.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I just got three little questions that I want to ask, because I want to know why a lot of the Bush supporters and Republican supporters, every time that we talk about Bush's failed policies, we say, well, what could Clinton have done? You know, and then my other question is, out of the impeachment of President Clinton, and you compare his presidency to George Bush, it seemed like the George Bush impeachment would have far outweighed a Bill Clinton in impeachment. And I just wonder why nobody ever thinks that, have sit there and listened to George Bush on television, think that didn't tell some lies. And if he had faulty information, he's the commander-in-chief, he should have been able to cipher through it and make a good decision.
Well, I think here we get into Phil, the very political question of assigning blame for all this, right?
You know, in truth, I couldn't hear all that the caller asked. But, as I say, the 9/11 Commission very much went out of its way not to make any judgments about human beings and their performance. There was to be, in the final report of the 9/11 Commission, a comparison of how often and how publicly President Clinton and President Bush talked about terrorist threats, talked mm-hmm. about it as the subject that the public needed to worry about. And the commission staff found that Bill Clinton had frequently and vigorously talked about the terrorist threat, and that George Bush had almost never talked about it. And all of that material was taken out of the final report. It was mm-hmm. it was pushed into the footnotes and was pretty much ignored.
Mm-hmm. Although, again, conceivably, the Clinton administration as well could have put together, number one, the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center. Number two, terrorists can use airplanes as bombs. Tried to do that at the Eiffel Tower, were thwarted. And they could have put all that together. I mean, they may have talked about it more, but they didn't seem to do their homework in a certain sense, eh?
No, I'm not giving a pass to the Clinton administration, though.
Yeah.
It does appear that if the same, the evidence that was pouring into the White House in the spring and summer of 2001, when the Bush administration was new to its job, obviously, at the White House, that if that level of information had been given, if that amount of information and intelligence had been given to the Clinton administration in the final years in office, an awful lot more would have been done by the federal government to mobilize to respond to it. The Clinton administration had faced a crisis at the time of the millennium when it sure appeared that terrorists were going to strike. And the record shows the Clinton administration had, daily meetings at the White House with the FBI director and the CIA director and the attorney general and said, you need to get out there and you need to connect the dots and you need to be aggressive to make sure that we're dealing with all threats. When even more dire intelligence poured in the White House in 2001 about a terrorist attack, there was no daily meeting. There was no real effort to mobilize the federal government to respond to it.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, thank you for your call. Next caller here, Bill, you're on the air. Bill, hi.
Thank you. As I understand it, the Clinton administration beefed up the presence of air marshals on the airplanes, the airliners, and when the Bush administration came into power, they scaled back that presence, and I was wondering why they did that and if that had not been done, perhaps 9/11 never would have occurred. If Al Gore had been elected instead of George Bush, then perhaps that scaling back of the presence of the air marshals would not have occurred, and Philip never would have had 9/11.
Understand, Philip? I've not heard about that before. Is that accurate?
I'm sorry. Your caller may know much more than I do. I've not heard that though. I do think the Sky Marshal program was scaled back. It's hard to imagine, though, that the scaling back is the cause of 9/11. I think even when the Sky Marshal program was at its height, you know, there was not a Sky Marshal aboard every commercial aircraft in this country, and it's hard to imagine that even at its height there would have been a Sky Marshal aboard each of those four flights.
Also, the Inspector General for the FAA, Mary Schiavo, had for years been trying to get them to beef up security, and she wanted to reinforce the cockpit doors for one thing, and I think Ralph Nader has famously said, or at least I think he's famously said, that if he had been elected, there would not have been a 9/11 because he would have ordered the reinforcement of the cockpit doors, at least done as much as he could to get that reinforcement.
I find that a little hard to believe, if only because before 9/11, the commercial aviation community, really even the federal government, were of the same mind about hijackings, which is that. If you let the hijackers take control, usually it will all end peacefully. And I think even on 9/11, what you might well have had on at least some of those planes was the pilot opening the cockpit door and trying to negotiate with the hijackers.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, because previously most hijackings, you know, you let the person go where they want to go, and they walk off the plane and everything's okay. Usually, right?
As I say, in the past, essentially what the federal government had urged and what the airlines had believed to be the case was that if somebody actually can commandeer an airplane, you let them go ahead because eventually it would all end peacefully. Obviously, 9/11 put an end to that theory.
Sure. Next caller here, Bob. Hello, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about the intelligence, which said that there was going to be an attack on the skyline of New York. It was an attack on the World Trade Center, which has symbolism of being like an attack on the entire market economy that affects a lot of nations. And a lot of the people who died in that attack were not just U.S. citizens, though they may have been from other countries who became U.S. citizens. And I wonder that when the Bush administration and others said, look, we've been attacked on our own soil, but it was an attack on the whole world. And I guess some of this was symbolic because some of the Islamic terrorists just think that we have gone way beyond what we should go in the way of this modernist bringing us together through markets and things. We talk about it being an attack on our soil, but it's also an attack on the world to an extent. You see what I'm getting at here?
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I think they chose the World Trade Center largely for purposes of symbolism because of what it represented. I do think it was rather, you know, pretty directly an attack on the United States and certainly an attack on the fundamentals of Western capitalism.
So did the intelligence about an attack on the skyline come before and after the initial failed attempt to have those trucks go in and bomb the World Trade Center?
Well, I say the chronology is in 1993, Muslim extremists go and try to bomb the world. They do bomb the World Trade Center. They try to bring them down.
Yeah.
8 years later, in the summer of 2001, the intelligence community, the law enforcement community, comes up with evidence to suggest that terrorists are conducting surveillance of the skyline of New York City, and that there's ongoing current evidence that there's going to be some sort of domestic hijacking plot. And I say those are pretty clear dots to connect, I think, but
yeah.
It sure doesn't seem that anybody did.
So we should have connected the dots that it might be an attack on the World Trade Center because of all the symbolism, not just the skyline in general.
Well, fair enough, but I think it seems to me you might want to beef up security around the World Trade Center and the Empire State Building and every other big symbol of America that existed in New York City.
I just have a comment.
Bob, got to move on. Thank you. Appreciate your call. 614-292-8513. Investigative reporter Philip Sheehan covered the activities of the 9/11 Commission for the New York Times. His new book is The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Of course, you can always email a comment or question to openline@wosu.org. Phil, prior to the independent 9/11 Commission, there was a congressional investigation, right? Headed up by former Democratic Senator Bob Graham of Florida. And that you write that that investigation found connections between the Saudi government and two of the hijackers.
Well, again, this is something that I don't think anybody's adequately followed up on. But the 9/11 Commission, as I say, was predated by a big congressional investigation, a House-Senate investigation of intelligence failures before 9/11. And it turned up an awful lot of evidence to suggest that at least that there was a support network that existed in Southern California to help the hijackers out, a network of young, mostly young, Arab men, many connected in some way to the government of Saudi Arabia, some on the payroll of the government of Saudi Arabia, and that they had known that these two men who were living in Southern California at the time, who would go on to be 9/11 hijackers, were bad guys, were al-Qaeda members. And the question became, what relationship existed between these elements of the Saudi government and the 9/11 plot and these two hijackers who had lived so openly in San Diego before the attacks? After the congressional investigation went out of business, the 9/11 Commission picked up on a lot of those plot threads and followed them through. And the young staffers on the commission believed very strongly that there was some sort of connection between some elements of the Saudi government and al-Qaeda and these two men who had lived openly in Southern California. But the 9/11 Commission really took most of that information out of its final report. And those mysteries about what elements of the Saudi government knew before 9/11, those are still unresolved today.
And it's important, as you say, it's important to say some elements of the Saudi government. I don't think anybody's suggesting that the heads of the Saudi government.
Nobody is saying that the, you know, the Saudi royal family knew about 9/11. But I think they are saying that there were clearly some elements, you know, mid-level elements, perhaps, of the Saudi government who supported al-Qaeda and who went out of their way to help these two hijackers who were living in the United States before 9/11.
Mm-hmm. So, Phil, you say there's a 28-page report about the Saudi connection that has been classified?
Right. The congressional investigation did a big report about 9/11 intelligence failures, and it took them many, many months to convince the White House to declassify most of this report. But 28 pages of that report remain classified to this day, secret from all of us. And I understand that those 28 pages involve specifically what happened in Southern California with these two hijackers and the possibility that they were being assisted by elements of the Saudi government.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we mentioned how political this whole commission was, given that the 2004 elections were going to be held, the presidential election, and they wrapped up their activities in spring of 2004. How political a document is it in the end? I mean, some people have called it a whitewash. I mean, is that fair to say, or is that a little bit much?
No, that is too strong, because in many ways, to this day, the 9/11 Commission remains the definitive account of what happened on the morning of 9/11. But I think it's clear that there's an awful lot of information that was left out of the final report of the 9/11 Commission. And it is political to the extent that the political decision was made very early on that there would be no accountability. There would be no accountability because it would create such a personal firestorm that the 9/11 Commission would never be able to decide on a unanimous report.
Mm-hmm. And there's real hostility. I mean, a part you have a scene at the commission's first meeting in New York City. And, you know, there's real hostility on the part of New York City officials to the commission. They didn't want to be investigated. They said everything we did was just fine on that day, right?
No, the very early on, the 9/11 Commission went up to New York City. The investigative staff led by Zelikow went up to New York City to, you know, announce that they would be needing files and intelligence out of the New York City government. And they faced a real stone wall. They faced overt hostility. The New York City government clearly felt that it was not answerable to the 9/11 Commission, to outside investigators, that it had done everything right, even though obviously history shows that it had not done everything right.
And what did the commission conclude about the scrambling of jets, our defense, our NORAD? You know, there was some question about the chronology of who knew what when in terms of the fact that these jets had been hijacked and were heading for New York and one heading for the Pentagon. Who did know what when and what was done?
Well, the answer at the end of the day seems to be that you know, there are two agencies that have responsibility for keeping the skies safe in the United States. One is the FAA, which deals mostly with civilian, you know, commercial planes, and the NORAD, which is the North American Aerospace Defense Command, which is part of the Defense Department, which is responsible really for protecting us from outside threats. And the 9/11 Commission pretty much came to the conclusion that both agencies had performed incompetently on the morning of 9/11, that they weren't passing information quickly or appropriately, and that, you know, any opportunity that might have existed to shoot down some of the four planes before they hit their targets was bungled. The 9/11 Commission also concluded that the Pentagon and the FAA had gone out of their way to try to hide the truth about all this, including apparently statements that may have been made under oath that were false.
Hmm. There was also a question. We remember that Vice President Cheney at a certain point had apparently given an order to shoot down after they locked down the whole air system and nobody was flying, if there were any planes headed for Washington, a passenger plane to shoot it down. And there's some question about whether he did that after consulting with President Bush or without consulting with him.
I think if you talk to the 9/11 commissioners and the staff now, they'll tell you that they believe they were told a false story by the vice president of the United States, Dick Cheney. Cheney, on the morning of 9/11, you'll remember that the president was down in Florida and Cheney was at the White House. That Cheney had issued an order shortly after the first attacks at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon for the Pentagon to be ready to shoot down any planes that approached the Capitol, approached Washington. And Cheney, the vice president of the United States, really has no military authority. He's really out of the chain of command when it comes to military decision-making. If a decision like a shoot-down is made, it has to be made by either the president or, if the president's unavailable, by the Secretary of Defense. But Cheney had issued this order, and he insisted to anyone who asked that he had issued this order only after he had gotten permission from the president, that he talked to the president approved this, and Cheney followed through. Well, every bit of evidence the 9/11 Commission could turn up suggested that Cheney had given this order unconstitutionally without any approval from the president. There hadn't been any communication with him. I think if you read between the lines of the 9/11 Commission, you can see that is the conclusion that they reached.
And what was it that Vice President Cheney tried to get removed from the report?
He tried to just this material. Mm-hmm. He thought he and his staff apparently felt strongly that anybody reading the 9/11 Commission would come to the conclusion that Cheney had, A, issued this unconstitutional order, and B, was lying about it. And he calls up Tom Kaine, the chairman of the commission, in the final stages of the investigation and sort of demands that this information come out. And Kaine and company decide not to remove it. And I say, if you read the final report of the 9/11 Commission, you can see pretty clearly they believe the vice president wasn't telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. Investigative reporter Philip Sheenan covered the activities of the 9/11 Commission for the New York Times. His new book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Pam joins us on the phone. Hello, Pam.
Hi. I'd like to ask the guest, do you know if there is a procedure where the incoming president meets with the outgoing president regarding terrorism matters? And if this procedure exists, was there ever an exchange between Clinton and Bush?
You mean about terrorism in particular?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. There is, there are meetings between the outgoing president and the incoming president, and I believe Clinton has said that he did brief Bush in detail about all of this, and I believe President Bush has said he doesn't remember being briefed in detail about all of this. I do think that, we're coming into what could be another dangerous period early next year with the transition between presidents. I think there's a belief that 9/11 that Al-Qaeda tries to take advantage of periods like a transition period to attack. And I think we better be wary of that next year as we head into a transition period.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask also, if, Clinton is saying that he did brief and Bush is saying he doesn't recall being briefed, don't they keep records of these things?
It's an interesting question as to whether or not there are records. They would presumably be highly classified. I don't mm-hmm. sense that if there were records, the 9/11 Commission ever got access to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, Pam, thanks for your question.
Thank you.
And here's Mark. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Good morning. I was able to catch a good part, but not all of your conversation this morning, so let me know if I've repeated the question. Something that occurred to me when this happened is there were the number of planes physically involved in incidents, and at a certain point, the FAA and the federal government ordered all the remaining planes to go down as quickly as possible, even if it's the wrong airport. They didn't want any more planes flying. The thing which, to the best of my knowledge, never happened, which would seem like the first thing you would have done, is there seemed to have been no attempt to identify, photograph, record all the people coming down on all the planes in the country. In other words, there were a number of planes physically involved in incidents, but there could have been other people that were on other planes that were ordered down that never acted out their roles. And if we didn't record who came down, we may have missed a lot of people. And if your guest had any thought of why there wasn't that attempt to identify the people who were ordered down quickly after the first couple planes had their
Okay, events. Phil?
I don't know that that wasn't done. You know, and of course, lists of those people still exist because presumably the FBI would have access to all the passenger information that was available from all the nation's airlines that morning. And we know that a lot of these hijackers on the 9/11 planes were listed under their real names. So presumably, I would have hoped that somebody with from the FBI or elsewhere would have gone through those passenger lists from that morning to see if there weren't any other suspicious characters on planes that morning.
And but they could, some of them could have had false ideas. So the idea of you physically would photograph everybody coming down at the airport from these things.
Yeah, but
it may take months to go through.
You'll recall the chaos of that morning. I think it's an awful lot to ask to photograph every passenger getting off every airplane at a at an airport around the country that morning.
Thousands and thousands of flights, I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, not individual, but just basically a videotape, which would be easy to sort.
But again, that would be an awful lot to – you remember the complete chaos of that day.
Yeah.
I just find it hard to believe that the government could have been prepared to go videotape and everybody getting off an airplane.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for your call. Phil, a couple of minutes left here. And you say the commission was the last best hope to find out a lot of this, these things that we don't know. And you've talked to the 9/11 widows. Some of them have formed a group to essentially to try and find out more. What is it that they're most concerned? What are they? What would they like to know most?
Well, they want to know more about everything. You know, they want to know more. I think. In many ways, unfortunately, some of the 9/11 families have now signed on to the conspiracy theory community that there was somehow an inside job. I think it would be useful if, you know, investigators in the journalism community and elsewhere continued to try to get to the bottom of the truth about what was known about al-Qaeda threats before 9/11, if only to debunk some of the crazier conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm. What can you do, though? In other words, you can't, as an investigative reporter, go to the National Security Agency and go through the files that I'm sure you would like to, that the commission retrospectively would have liked to. What is their material in terms of investigation?
What
materials could there be? I mean, how could you continue to investigate?
Well, I think we said at the beginning of the hour, you know, apparently a tremendous amount of secret information is sitting at the National Security Agency at this moment about al-Qaeda and terrorist threats before 9/11. Maybe it would be useful if somebody went in there and went through it.
But it would have to be – it couldn't be you as a journalist, right?
No, it would have to be somebody from within the federal government. Now, you know, Congress – I think has talked about revisiting some of these issues, and if you have a new party in office in January, perhaps that might happen.
Mm-hmm. We have time. Say, Steve, you're on the line. If you're very quick, we can hear from you. Oh, hi.
Okay, I just wanted to mention that Richard Clark, in his first book after he got fired from the government, stated that he met with Bush officials several different times.
Oh yeah, we know that.
Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, we understand that.
Yeah.
I guess the
question... I mean, you're talking about the presidents rolling over, the one talking to the other. I doubt if Clinton talked to Bush. I'm sure that some official did. Yeah.
No, I think they did talk. You know, I think it's not surprising that president to president, they talked to each other. And it occurs to me that talk may well have been in utter privacy, just the two men.
Mm-hmm.
And so there would be no record of it, presumably.
Uh-huh. But certainly we know that underlings did do that conversation. Phil, do you have any further plans to continue investigating here, continue pursuing this?
Well, I say I'm considering a range of topics for my next book, and some of them may touch on 9/11 and indeed may touch on some of these conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm. And you clearly regard them as conspiracy theories, this idea of an inside
job. I don't find any convincing evidence of an inside job.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, I just do not think our government has the competence to carry out such a deadly and sophisticated terrorist attack like this. Mm-hmm.
Investigative reporter Philip Sheenan covered the 9/11 Commission, its activities for the New York Times, and also interviewed Commission members after in the aftermath and other members of the government as well. His current book, fascinating book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Phil, thanks for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Thanks, Brett. A pleasure.
When we come back, a Columbus Dispatch investigation of the immigration crackdown on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.